Hello, welcome to The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Expert witness immunity. Gone, just like that, 400 years of legal doctrine. The highest court in the UK recently ruled that expert witnesses who give evidence in court cases can be sued if they stuff up. This is a fundamental shift in the status of expert witnesses, a group that play an essential role in our trial system.
The whole purpose of an expert is to assist the court, and it's to assist the court in an area that the judge is not familiar with. So, you know, you've got handwriting experts, you've got, you know, medical experts.
You get forensic accountants, you have people who in criminal trials will speak about the effects of drug use, the level that someone's been affected by alcohol when they've been, for example, driving a motor vehicle or committing a crime. Cases about, for example, financial loss will often have someone come along to speak about the calculation of that loss, the loss of profit, what's going to happen in the future, tax implications, those sorts of things.
Expert witnesses. Without their input, judges and juries would often be totally unable to reach sensible decisions. Doctors and other health professionals play an especially important role. In accident compensation cases, they're the ones who give evidence about the nature and the seriousness of any injuries. Traditionally, if an expert witness is negligent, they can't be sued. But the highest court in the UK has just overturned this long-standing principle. This decision is one of a number in recent years where UK courts have removed immunities for those involved in court processes. Some years ago, they also allowed barristers who stuff up in a court case to be sued. Now, the question for us here in Australia is, will Australian courts follow the UK's lead? Will we remove the immunity of expert witnesses and also the immunity of barristers? But first, let's go back to the recent decision of the UK Supreme Court, a rather ordinary road accident case in Northern England, the case which led to the felling of a 400-year-old legal principle. Christopher Stanton is a partner with the Liverpool office of Hill Dickinson.
My firm's client, Mr. Jones, he was involved in a road traffic accident back in 2001. He was on his motorcycle, stationary at traffic lights, and he was hit by a drunk, uninsured driver called Mr. Bennett. He instructed solicitors and brought a claim for damages for personal injury against Mr. Bennett, and the Motors Insurers Bureau, who cover uninsured drivers, dealt with a claim. He instructed a Dr. Caney, who's a clinical psychologist, as an expert witness to support his claim for damages. She advised that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. The other driver, Mr. Bennett's insurers, they obtained an expert report from a clinical psychologist as well, from a Dr. Al Azra. He advised that Mr. Jones was exaggerating his symptoms. And as happens in the UK, the court then ordered the two experts to produce a joint statement of issues on which they agreed and disagreed. And as is fairly common, the experts spoke by telephone. Dr. Al Azra then produced a joint draft statement, which he sent to Dr. Caney, which stated basically that Mr. Jones had not suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the accident. Dr. Caney doesn't seem to have read the joint statement. She doesn't seem to have even seen Dr. Al Azra's original report. She simply signed the report, sent it back.
Why on earth did she sign this statement? If she handed Mr. Jones a previous report stating that she believed that he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder?
She said that she felt under pressure to do so. And, I mean, she had no rational explanation for it beyond the fact that, you know, she was presented with this draft report. It didn't reflect her views, but she felt under pressure to sign it, which she did and sent it back. Now, at that stage, the solicitors who'd instructed her tried to get permission from the court to get further evidence to support the claim, to basically overturn this joint report, but they were refused in doing so. And so Mr. Jones was stuck with two experts saying, basically, you haven't got post-traumatic stress disorder, and he had to settle his claim on terms.
The effect of Ms. Caney signing this document was to completely undermine his legal claim for damages.
Yeah, his claim was basically hole beneath the waterline, and there was no way of getting it back. So his lawyers were basically forced to settle on terms. What's unusual is that she actually wrote to the solicitors, who were obviously not happy at, you know, what she'd done, and admitted that she hadn't read the report and that she didn't agree with the contents. So when it came to the negligence claim that was subsequently brought by Mr. Jones, she basically admitted breach of duty. And the key issue in the subsequent negligence claim was, you know, whether she could effectively take the protection and hide behind the cloak of immunity that expert witnesses have always had.
This is a cloak of immunity that has existed for something like 400 years.
It's a cloak of immunity that goes, way back when. I'm not sure that anybody actually knows when it first started.
So it kind of got referred up to the UK Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those issues that lawyers and the courts have been waiting for some time for the right case to go. It was an issue that clearly needed to be considered by the court. There was no point in taking it to the Court of Appeal because they'd be bound by the earlier decision as well. So everybody agreed that it should leapfrog to the Supreme Court.
Now, up until this decision, there was this 400-odd years of legal precedent. What was the legal status quo and what was the rationale behind giving an immunity for witnesses who gave expert evidence in a court proceeding?
The main rationale is the expert owes an overriding duty of care to the court and that you shouldn't be persuaded in any way, shape or form to act in favour of your client over and above the court, and that why should experts face potential claims from their clients for simply, you know, doing their job, doing their duty to the court.
So this case was heard by the UK Supreme Court and they recently came down with a decision. I think it was 5-2.
The Supreme Court is normally a 5-judge court. This was a 7-judge court and the lead judgment was given by Lord Phillips, who, as you may know, is president of the Supreme Court.
And what was at the heart of Lord Phillips' judgment?
Lord Justice Lord Phillips rejected that argument. He said that you owe an overriding duty as an expert to the court, and your duty is to give full and frank evidence, but that duty shouldn't conflict with your duty to the client. Basically, you give your advice for the benefit of the client, but if further evidence emerges or an expert's later persuaded that your initial view was wrong, then you owe the same duty both to the court and to your client to make any concessions that arise from that. And to be honest, experts already face the risk of a wasted costs order against them if they give, you know, improper evidence anyway. So he rejected that argument, and his basic reasoning was the onus is upon the expert to justify why they should have this cloak of immunity. And Lord Phillips's view was basically, if an expert witness has been negligent, as happened here, I mean, Dr. Caney admitted that she had been in breach of duty. She was simply saying, well, I've been in breach of duty, but you can't sue me because I've got immunity. And his view was, you know, no, that is wrong, as almost as a matter of public policy. You shouldn't be able to hide behind this cloak. You know, if I as a solicitor am negligent and as a result of my negligence, my client loses the chance to bring a claim against another party, my client can sue me. Why should it be any different for an expert? You know, experts, be it medics or construction professionals or whoever, they all carry professional indemnity insurance anyway. And, you know, if you're a obstetrician, you know, you face the risk of a negligence claim if you act negligently at the birth of a child. Well, that doesn't stop the obstetrician acting in those circumstances. And his view is, well, you know, similarly for an expert, the fact that they may face the risk of being sued in this area is no different from, you know, their ordinary professional life.
And I wonder, Christopher Stanton, have there been a flood, people knocking on your door with claims about dodgy expert witnesses since this decision?
Not a wave. I mean, I've had one or two people telephone me as a result of this decision looking to potentially bring claims. I don't think there is going to be a wave because in order to bring a claim against an expert, you're going to have either expert witness evidence saying that the original witness was negligent, because if you haven't got that, your case doesn't get off the ground, or the expert themselves is going to have to admit that they'd been negligent in the first place, which is what happened with Dr. Caney. So I don't see that there is going to be a wave of claims. There certainly wasn't a wave of claims against barristers following the earlier decision. It hasn't stopped barristers acting as advocates. So I doubt that there will be an increase of claims, and I suspect that there will be one or two test cases brought to try and extend the boundaries. And certainly one of the concerns of the two dissenting judges was mission creep.
What do you mean by mission creep?
Well, there are two dissenting judges, Lord Hope and Lady Hale, And they were concerned about what they described as an obvious conflict between the duties that the expert owes on the one hand to the court and on the other hand to their client. I think Lady Hale in particular, her background is as an academic lawyer, in particularly in family and public law. Her real concern was what impact this decision would have in the area of family proceedings, where you might have experts advising on, you know, not just with the parents, but you've got issues involving children, often vulnerable children, and what impact it may have upon an expert who hitherto has not faced the prospect of a negligence claim, and what impact that may have. And her view was very much, this is not a matter for judges to make a decision on. This is really a matter of public policy.
I think one of the arguments of the minority was that, look, litigants are often going to be very, very cranky if a decision doesn't go their way, and they'll be looking for someone to blame, so they might well turn around and blame the experts.
Yeah, but to be honest, the obvious people that you would normally blame if you don't like the decision is your lawyers. It's your lawyers who advise, whether it be the barrister or whether it be the solicitor. And advocates' immunity was removed 10 or 11 years ago. And certainly the Bar Mutual, who are the compulsory insurers for all barristers, as far as I'm aware, have noted no real increase in notifications by barristers of potential claims against them. They've seen really very little rise at all in respect of claims against barristers in respect of settlements and undervalue and things like that. So although one of the great fears 10 years ago was that you would have this wave of litigation, it hasn't happened.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that case a few years ago, some 10 years ago. Your firm acted in that groundbreaking case, Hall and Simmons, which overturned the long-standing legal principle of barrister's immunity. What were the facts in that case? What sort of negligence were we talking about in that case?
It related to what was frankly protracted litigation on a building dispute. The claimant's solicitors had acted for the defendant in that litigation. And on the eve of trial, the defendant had been advised by counsel to settle the proceedings on terms. And then the solicitors sued for unpaid fees and, as so often happens, were then faced with a counterclaim themselves. And they brought a claim for damages for negligence and breach of duty in conducting that litigation. Now, it was litigation involving solicitor and client, but the principles related to advocates' immunity as a whole. So at first instance, the claim was struck out against the solicitors because it was viewed as being unsustainable, but the Court of Appeal overturned that. And their rationale was similar to that in Jones and Caney, that there's no public reason for allowing barristers' immunity. And it was really the administration of justice and public perception was the reasoning behind it. Although arguments were made that there would be the same conflict of interest for barristers between the duty they owe to the court on the one hand and to the client on the other, and the fear that this would expose them to vexatious litigation. And they also said, well, you know, if expert witnesses can't be sued either, so nor should we be. But the court dismissed that. Now, the great fear at the time was that, you know, no advocate is ever going to want to stand up in court and represent a client if they face the risk of being sued as a result. In my experience, I can't think of a single barrister who has, as a result of Arthur Hall and Simon, has you know, pulled out of advocacy and acting for a claimant in litigation. You know, that's the nature of the job. And the court was very clear that if a vexatious claim is being brought, I mean, if, for example, a criminal brings a claim against his barrister for negligence, you know, I've got 20 years in jail and it's all because of you. Well, frankly, unless his conviction's already been overturned and it's shown that it was overturned because of the negligence of his advisers, then that's not going to get beyond first base because it's a clear abuse of process and the court's going to throw it out.
What's really interesting is that Australia has not followed the UK down the path of removing barristers' immunity. In 2005, we had a case, Daughter Ekeneki, I think it is, the decision of our High Court. It upheld the principle that barristers can't be sued. So it's unclear, too, whether we will follow you down the path blazed by Caney and Jones. I'm really interested, do you know what the situation is in other comparable jurisdictions?
Yeah, to be honest, it's a bit of a mishmash because, I mean, as I understand it, in Australia, expert witnesses still have immunity as well. But in New Zealand, lawyers no longer have immunity. I think there was a decision in 2006 which basically followed Arthur Hall and Simons. But experts are still immune. Now, you know, you do wonder whether New Zealand, following Jones and Caney, will remove expert immunity in the coming years. I suspect that may well happen. Canada, on the other hand, I think lawyers' immunity was removed in 1863. And that was reaffirmed in a decision in 1979 as well. But experts still have immunity. So you've got lawyers having not had immunity for the best part of 150 years, but experts still being immune in Canada. In America, lawyers don't have any immunity at all, except for prosecutors and public defenders. As I understand it, expert witnesses vary from state to state. But most states do not provide for expert witness immunity in America. So there's no one line that countries take. Different countries have different views, both in respect of advocates and in respect of experts. So whether that will now change as a result of Jones and Caney, you know, particularly in Commonwealth countries that might be influenced more by the UK Supreme Court, only time will tell.
Christopher Stanton, partner with the Liverpool office of Hill Dickinson. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast each week on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. The program is also available for download at our website. That's at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. At the site you can also read transcripts or leave us a comment. Today, a conversation about whether or not an expert witness in a court case should be sued. As UK lawyer Christopher Stanton points out, the immunity dumped in the UK is still alive and well here in Australia. Bill Madden is a senior lawyer with the Sydney office of Slater and Gordon. He's an expert in medical law. I asked him what he thinks of the immunity.
Immunities are one of those things which are often disappearing in the mists of time and history, I suppose, and over time they've become less and less popular in a number of areas. In Australia, the issue was last looked at in about 2005, and the court at that stage said that immunity should continue. But with these recent changes in England, that may change.
So you think it's possible that one day we might follow the UK?
Yes, I do.
Well, what do you say to the argument that in the UK now, in light of this decision, there's now a risk that experts will be reluctant to give evidence in court because they know that they could open themselves up to a legal suit?
Well, that's true, but you could say the same thing about doctors being reluctant to operate on patients because they could leave themselves open to be sued for making a mistake during the course of the operation. I think people cope with those sorts of risks. It's part of the overall nature of the work they do, and if they're obviously careful and sensible, then that's not a risk that arises. I don't think the possibility of being sued for giving incorrect advice is any different than the possibility that, you know, I might be sued tomorrow for giving incorrect advice. I still try and do the right thing.
Well, speaking of actions against lawyers, of course, the UK also changed its laws about the immunity of barristers or advocates some years ago, and we didn't follow them down that path. I think we had a decision here of the High Court in, I think, 2005 in the Daughter Ekenaike case, which upheld that barrister's immunity. What was that case and why was there that finding?
That case involved a barrister and an argument. It was originally a gentleman who had been charged with a sexual assault, and there was a suggestion that he was given advice to plead guilty when it was later said he shouldn't have been given that advice. And subsequently there was a claim or an attempt to bring a claim by him against the barrister who gave him that advice. The High Court, as you say, didn't follow the English House of Lords, it was at that stage, decision, and decided to maintain the immunity that had been recognised in Australia.
My understanding is that Mr. Daughter Ekenaike spent something like 5 months in jail before he was able to secure a retrial and, if you like, take back that guilty plea.
Yeah, he was later acquitted, I think, of the charges that were brought against him. But the High Court, when it looked at that decision, was more concerned with the principle of immunities and whether, for reasons of, and there are two reasons, I suppose, finality in litigation and also general public policy reasons, whether some people, barristers, witnesses, etc., should have an immunity from a later claim against them.
Certainly when it comes to barristers, it does seem a bit irksome that a profession that makes a living hauling other people into court, with a view to finding them liable for negligence often, themselves are beyond any scrutiny in this department.
Whether they're beyond scrutiny, I suppose, is a different issue, because you then look at the possibility of disciplinary action against them. But in terms of a civil claim for financial compensation, certainly the law in Australia at the moment, for at least some of their work that involves court representation, is that they have an immunity. But as you say, England has departed from that path, both now for barristers and for expert witnesses. And I think it's a bit of an open question in Australia as to whether we will do the same for consistency. You would assume that if the immunities were to be wound back, expert witnesses would perhaps be an easier option, but barristers may well follow.
Do you have a view about the barrister's immunity?
I think, like so many of these questions, we're right on the edge of the law and on the edge of public policy as to what the law should do. There is a lot of merit in the argument that once someone goes to court and they've been through their appeal process, they shouldn't then be able to turn around and try and re-argue the whole thing again by suing, for example, their witnesses or their barristers or their solicitors. But it is a public policy question, and it's something which the Supreme Court in England, some of the judges there ultimately said that the Parliament should make a decision about what to do with the law in that area. And it's possible that the same thing could be said here, and that it's up to the states and the Commonwealth to make a decision about those questions.
Indeed, after the Dr. Ekenaki decision, there was talk of legislative reform here in Australia, but that never seemed to have gotten off the ground.
No, and I mean, it's hard to know exactly why that was. It may be that the Parliament formed the view ultimately that the law was right in its present form and didn't need to be changed. That's a possibility, but I'm only speculating about that.
In terms of the barrister's immunity, there's a question about how far it should go, whether it should include any advice given by a barrister or what actually happens when a barrister is on his or her feet in court. Do you think there's an issue there about where you should draw the line?
Oh, certainly there is. And barristers in practice have professional indemnity insurance. And obviously they wouldn't have that. They wouldn't have a need for that if they thought that no matter what they did, they were immune from any sort of civil claim. So there'll be some things that they will be liable for. And it's really that advocacy in court and things associated with the advocacy in court that are the areas of traditional immunity.
But my understanding was that in the Dr. Ekenaki case, the advice given to the client to plead guilty wasn't given on the steps of the court. It was given some time before the actual committal hearing.
That's true. But having said that, it was part of an overall strategy as to how to best represent that man's position. So, for example, it may be that the barrister took the view that if he was to plead not guilty, he may end up with a more severe penalty than if he had, and was convicted obviously, than if he had simply pleaded guilty and sought some indulgence from the court.
So the idea between distinguishing between what goes on in court or part of a court process and other advice, the idea is that the questions that a barrister, say, does or doesn't ask in a witness box, or whether they call or don't call a particular witness, or whether you cross-examine or don't cross-examine a particular witness, if that became the potential subject of litigation, then you'd have, this would lead to trials about trials. It would become pretty circular.
Exactly. And the other problem, of course, is what do you then do about the involvement of the judge? Do, for example, if you've said, if you try and run an argument to say you should have cross-examined witness X, do you then have to ask the judge to come along and give evidence as to whether they would have made a different decision? Or if it's a jury trial, do you have to call all the jury members as witnesses? And as you can imagine, that could become a never-ending process, particularly for people who perhaps have been convicted of criminal offences and are spending their time in jail. To some extent, they've got nothing to lose.
And I guess at the end of the day, some litigants or some people involved in legal proceedings, if they lose a case, they'll never think that it was about the weakness of their position. They'll always look for other reasons.
That's right.
I remember during the aftermath of the daughter Ekenaike case, there were doctors who were particularly irate with this decision, saying we can be hauled before courts, we can find ourselves in trouble if we don't do our job correctly. But the lawyers who often drag us into court are not able to be brought to court. And this we find difficult and unjust.
Well, it's certainly one of those difficult areas and one of those areas of balance. As I said before, the courts, when if you look at, for example, the Australian decision, it makes a point of saying that the immunity is not provided to benefit, in that case, the barrister, or it's not provided in particular to benefit the expert witness. It's more a focus on what society as a whole expects from the court system in terms of finality. There are lots of things that lawyers and barristers can be sued for, but it's one particular area of their work associated with the finality of court decisions where the immunity has traditionally been available.
And what are those areas of work that they can be sued for?
Well, you can imagine, for example, if a barrister was entirely unconnected with a court case, was giving advice about someone's tax structure, for example, and managed to make an error in that advice, then they could well be sued for that. Someone giving advice about rights associated with the transaction of land or the purchase of a business, all of those things, a barrister or a solicitor can be sued if they're negligent in the provision of that advice.
People outside the profession will be saying, look, the judges have ruled on this and the judges are also inside the legal profession. There could be the perception that this immunity, rather than it being based in sound public policy considerations, does stem from a degree of self-interest. Can you understand that perception?
Very much so. And I think if you actually read the judgment, you'll see that the judges themselves, when they're looking at the reasons for these immunities, look at the advantages and look at the disadvantages, and they make a decision one way or another. But ultimately, it's up to the Parliament. And as you said before, it's now been 6 years since that 2005 decision about barristers' immunity in Australia. And for whatever reason, the parliaments, the governments, the attorneys general, all of those people, none of them have stepped forward to introduce a piece of legislation into Parliament to change the law. And that's something they do every day. That's something they could do very easily if they thought it was the right thing to do.
You are, of course, quite interestingly positioned in this debate. You're a leading plaintiff lawyer. Your expertise is in medico-legal issues. Can I ask you, you think that the immunity should be removed for experts. Can I ask you to give a call on whether you reckon the immunity should be removed on barristers?
It's a very difficult issue, Damien. I think the problem is you can identify cases where you would read that particular story, for example, in the English case, and imagine if a barrister was to make a similar mistake. It would be very difficult to convince yourself that that barrister should have an immunity. But on the other hand, finality in, for example, criminal proceedings is an important element of the justice system, and there are already safeguards designed to deal with those factors. So, for example, you can have an appeal, you can seek a retrial if there's been some particular error. On balance, my personal view is that immunity for expert witnesses probably should be done away with, but I can well recognise that a lot of people will have a different view. And so far as barristers are concerned, I think it's a more difficult question, but I would expect that if we were having this conversation in 10 or 20 years' time, that law would have changed.
Bill Madden, senior lawyer with the Sydney office of Slater and Gordon. That's the Law Report for this week. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks to producer Erica Vowles and technical producer Brendan O'Neill. Do visit our website at abc.net.au/rn/lawreport. There you can download audio, listen to the program online, read a transcript, or leave a comment. Do join me next week for more law.
David Hume was a great philosopher and a sceptic, but was he a sceptic when it came to morals? What did he have to say about why we should behave well and what it is to behave well? To find out why Hume believed that the emotions are what matters when it comes to morality and reason alone doesn't cut it, download this Philosopher's Zone from the Radio National website.